have to spend money to move. If they don't put money down to move, that also is a verification that this battle's over for now.
Alaska's congressional delegation works to protect Eielson Air Force Base. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what declining wolf numbers in Denali National Park could mean for tourism.
To be quite honest with you, we're planning a very similar trip with another state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
The U.S. Senate passed a bill today outlining the nation's defense policy for the year. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the bill could potentially delay the closure of Eielson Air Force Base.
Despite bipartisan calls for reining in federal spending, there's zero appetite in Congress for closing military bases. The last base realignment and closure, or BRAC, in 2005 spared Eielson Air Force Base. Earlier this year, the Air Force indicated plans to relocate the F-16 squadron from Fairbanks to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. An amendment from Senator Mark Begich would require the military to report a cost-benefit analysis in any reduction in force at any given base.
They want to start picking away at these bases and take 100 people, 200 people, 300 people, and by the time they get to a certain amount, then they say, well, there's not enough people there to have a base, so we'll close it.
The rule would force the Air Force to share the study results with Congress, which has authority over the BRAC process. Both Senator Begich and Senator Lisa Murkowski have labeled the Air Force's proposed reduction a backdoor BRAC. Senator Murkowski says Eielson has a longer runway than J-Bear and less traveled airspace. She wants the Air Force to report on not just the cost of the move, but also the benefits of keeping the base open.
Tell us what the potential is as part of your evaluation.
The studies coincide with the required environmental impact statement, and each of them could stall any potential move. Senator Begich says the Defense Department budget, which could be released to the White House this month, will be an indication of the Air Force's intent.
If they have not put any money down for this next year to move, because they're going to have to spend money to move, if they don't put money down to move, that also is a verification that this battle's over for now.
The House has already passed its defense authorization. Now both chambers of Congress need to meld the bills and pass a final conference report. The House version has a similar plan from U.S. Representative Don Young. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich is shrugging off Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell's announcement he may run against the incumbent in 2 years. Treadwell said last week he's considering forming an exploratory committee. That's the first step to officially entering a race. It gives him a chance to feel out public opinion and see which donors are willing to come forward. Treadwell says hundreds of people have reached out with support since he announced his plans last Friday in Fairbanks. He says if he officially chooses to run and wins the GOP primary, he'll face a well-financed incumbent.
He's been raising money several hundred thousand dollars a quarter, and I think that's one reason why it's important to get an exploratory committee started.
Treadwell says he'll meet with state GOP leaders Saturday, though he has yet to speak with the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. Senator Begich says he expects Treadwell to face challengers in a primary, like former candidate Joe Miller and former Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman.
Whoever runs, runs. And I don't ever worry about that. I've had times where I've had one opponent, as many as 13 running against me for different offices. We'll focus on our issues. We'll focus on talking about our record. And 2 years from now, we'll see who wins.
A GOP primary fight would benefit Senator Begich. Begich says it seems early for a candidate to announce for an election 2 years off. The decline of at least one wolf pack along the eastern border of Denali National Park and Preserve has wildlife advocates concerned that wolf watching in and around the park could become a thing of the past. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the groups argue that a decline in the wolf population could have a dire impact on the local economy.
In 2010, Alaska's Board of Game eliminated a buffer along the northeastern boundary of Denali National Park and Preserve. The buffer was set up to protect park wolves that wandered across the boundary into state land, where hunting and trapping is legal. Before 2010, National Park Service data show that 45% of visitors who traveled to the Eielson Visitor Center in Denali successfully caught sight of a wolf. But this year, Park Service wildlife biologist Bridget Borg says wolf sightings have declined.
The probability of a westbound trip to Eielson or further seeing a wolf in 2012 was estimated at 12%.
Kirk Hessel is the president of Alaska Wildland Adventures. His company leads small group nature tours throughout the state. He says wildlife viewing is a major draw for his clients.
For the most part, people are, you know, have a wide variety of interests and they don't really have any targeted species. However, there are some that have very specific, you know, animals they want to see. And then our job is to, in the sales end of things, is be realistic with them as what their chances of seeing those wildlife are.
Wolves are notoriously elusive. Park Service employees survey for wildlife throughout the year. But for guides like Kirk Hessel, who don't spend entire seasons in the park, sightings are more rare. Hessel says he's been on the park road hundreds of times in 3 decades, and he can count the number of times he's seen wolves on both hands.
It's hard to know whether that's as a result of getting lucky or whether it's a result of less wolves in the park.
One wolf pack in the park had a reputation for its visibility, but this past spring, the Park Service announced that the Grant Creek pack has dispersed. The announcement drastically changed Diane Bentivania's summer travel plans.
This was our maiden voyage, so to speak.
Bentivania is the education director at the National Wolf Watcher Coalition, a nonprofit wolf advocacy group based in New York State. She was working with Kirk Hessel and Alaska Wildland Adventures to plan a guided wolf watching trip in Denali for up to 20 people next summer.
This would have been a regular experience of ours, probably 2 to 3 times a year from here on in. However, the outlook is so bleak at this point. To be quite honest with you, we're planning a very similar trip with another state.
Wildlife advocates argue that a decline in Denali's wolf population could have a serious impact on ecotourism and Alaska's economy. According to a report from the Anchorage and Juneau-based McDowell Group, wildlife viewing was the second most popular activity for tourists visiting Alaska in 2011. The report also indicates that spotting wild animals was the number one activity for visitors to interior Alaska. Those who traveled to Denali were more likely to look for wildlife. If Bentivania had followed through with her plans, she says a group of at least 20 visitors could have brought up to $170,000 to the state.
We'd be paying for food, lodging, transportation, guide fees, public land use fees, equipment rentals, and related kinds of things like binoculars and cameras and special lenses and field guides, maps and backpacking equipment. It is a trip that requires substantial financial investment.
Groups including the Alaska Wildlife Alliance pointed to the economic benefits of wolf watching when they petitioned the Alaska Board of Game 3 times this summer to reestablish the buffer zone along the park boundary. Conservation biologist Rick Steiner authored the petitions.
And there's 400,000 people that visit Denali each year, and most of them want to see wolves. Financial estimates are that Denali tourism contributes over $140 million a year to Alaska's economy. And so by protecting just the 20 or 30 wolves in eastern Denali, by giving a little bit of a buffer on the eastern edge of the park, the state would be enhancing that economic activity.
The board denied all 3 petitions as well as an emergency order request. Acting Board of Game Chairman Ted Spraker says there's no scientific evidence that points to a serious decline in the wolf population. He says the board considers economic benefits in their decision-making process.
We understand those, you know, those facts about the cost of a wolf and, you know, what it provides to a trapper, what it provides to a lot of people that look at it.
The same groups who petitioned the Board of Game this year have requested a second emergency order from Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell. They say they may approach the state legislature next spring. They've also made mention of working with the Federal Department of the Interior to address wolf protection in and around Denali. For KUAC News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new rules on hunting caribou near Bethel. Hunt like an elder.
They get the animals they need without chasing them at all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
The cold snap that's been gripping the interior for more than a week now finally pushed the mercury to 50 below in the Delta Junction area, so Delta Greeley School District officials canceled classes this morning. The Delta District is one of the few in the interior that closes schools if the temperature drops too low. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Delta Greeley district officials canceled classes at all three schools this morning after learning that the temperature at the school bus garage read at least 50 below. It's happened twice over the past couple of years, and this is the first time this year. When it does happen, District Secretary Sharon Waldo says her office sends out emails to faculty and staff and notifies local radio stations, and an automated system gets the word out to parents telephonically.
There will be an alert now for all parents. There's an automated system that calls.
But the Delta Greeley District is the only one in the interior that has a policy of closing schools when it gets too cold. Even though TOC recorded its first official 50 below reading last week, the superintendent of the area school district says students shouldn't think they'll be getting out of classes on account of the cold weather.
You know, if the kids are holding out for a cold day, they're probably going to be out of luck for a while because we usually don't close school at all.
Superintendent Todd Pogue says he's never closed all the district schools due to cold in the 6 years he's headed up the Alaska Gateway School District. That's pretty much the same policy as the Denali Borough School District, says Superintendent James Elliott. Fairbanks North Star Borough School District spokesman Bill Bailey says that district also does not close schools due to cold. He says the district's policy is to keep elementary age kids indoors for recess when it hits 20 below, and the district curtails field trips and other activities beginning at 30 below. Bailey says the district is much more likely to cancel classes when it's warmer, even temporarily, like during a Chinook, because that often means the roads are slick and that can make it hazardous to transport kids to school.
You know, we run into some rainy days and where driving conditions will impact student safety and staff safety. And at that point, we'll assess whether or not school should be canceled, but not due to cold weather.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The University of Alaska is looking at healthcare plan changes. The university covers more than 80% of the cost of health insurance for about 4,000 employees. As KUAC's Dan Ross reports, many of the plan changes are aimed at reining in costs, which are rising 7 to 10% a year.
A joint healthcare committee representing union staff and administration came up with 9 health plan change proposals. One would spread costs over more people by eliminating workers' current option of rejecting UA coverage. University spokeswoman Kate Wadham says there's also a $1,200 surcharge for spouses who have other insurance options.
It's not surcharging all spouses. It's people who make a decision to come over to the university plan who already otherwise have access to another insurance.
Another change implements new insurance plan tiers for the addition of 1, 2, or 3 or more children. Joint Health Care Committee Chair, University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Abel Bull-Ito says it's about fairness.
Every person person who is on the health care plan will contribute to the cost of the plan. So the idea was that to increase the tiers, to increase one child, two children, or more than three children, would more evenly spread the costs to those people who have more people on the plan.
The changes follow across-the-board health care premium increases this spring. Juella Sparks, chair of the UA Staff Alliance, says unrepresented employees do not have guaranteed raises and are hit harder by health insurance hikes.
I've heard many staff say that their take-home pay, that you know, the money that they get to take home at the end of the day is going down because the cost of their health care benefits and other things are going up. That's the challenge here, is people feel like they're going backwards.
Not all the health plan changes add costs. One enhances the wellness program. UA's Wadham says healthy living will be rewarded.
There will be a preferred pricing program for people who are active and maintain healthier lifestyles.
Health Committee Chair Bolt Ito says the voluntary wellness program starts with basic biometrics like weight and blood pressure, with points awarded for good numbers and positive changes.
If people, you know, achieve increases in their health, whether it's more activity, did they get their flu shot, did they lose some weight, then that might be tied to some incentives.
Boltito says the details of the health plan changes won't be set until a February meeting. He says one thing that has not been talked about is whether employee insurance charges should correspond with level of compensation. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A meeting about the federal government's Fishery Observer Program drew a large crowd of vessel owners to the Petersburg Fire Hall last week. Federal officials addressed dozens of questions and concerns from local fishermen, most of whom will be included in the program for the first time starting in January. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has a look at some of those questions.
The Federal Observer Program in Alaska dates back to the late 70s, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service's Martin Lefled, who told the crowd this was the first big tune-up in 23 years for the program. Until now, it's mainly affected boats over 60 feet long, fishing groundfish like pollock and cod.
And that program now is expanding to the halibut fleet, and it's going down to boats less than 60 feet. So we're going down to 40 feet.
As Lefled explained, the observer's job is to gather data for NIMFS and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, as well as for the industry.
We're doing it partly for you, partly for us, for our agency responsibilities, and to a great extent for the council. Because the council and all of us here are charged with managing these fisheries, and we're trying to get good estimates. Catch, bycatch, discards, halibut mortality. How are people handling those fish?
In the new program, much of the Petersburg fleet generally falls into a category called partial coverage. That's for vessels 40 to 60 feet long that are fishing halibut or groundfish in federal fisheries. The vessel owners in the audience didn't raise objections to being observed. Rather, many of their concerns and questions focused on the logistics of carrying an observer, an extra person on a small boat with limited room and an often changing fishing schedule. How will it affect or impede their operations? What's the skipper's responsibilities under the program? For instance, what if your boat's selected but the observer's delayed because of weather? Or maybe there are so many boats heading out at the same time that there are not enough observers. Gary Slavin was one of several people who raised that issue with NIMFS Glenn Campbell. Campbell repeatedly emphasized that once a skipper gave the proper notice, it was up to NIMFS and its contractor to provide an observer in time.
Let's say 70 trips from this port get logged and 35 of them get picked for observer coverage. That's their responsibility to somehow get those observers there.
But my question is, what happens if they don't have an observer?
Again, it goes back to the same stuff.
It's the same thing.
It's the same stuff. We are not going to keep you at the dock. If everybody followed their rules and they were unable to get you an observer, you are released from coverage and you can go fishing.
For nearly 3 hours, fishermen in the audience raised scenario after scenario and issue after issue. The NIMFS staffers tried to answer each question in turn. The meeting was sometimes tense, but pretty friendly overall, and they were able to address a wide range of concerns, but the last issue of the evening proved to be quite thorny. NIMFS plans to collect 1.25% of the value of each landing to pay for the program. The fee in itself wasn't as much the problem, but the staffers said the agency would be using a standardized value based on the previous year's prices. And that was a serious concern for several in the audience who pointed out that the fleet would end up paying more than 1.25% if prices are down, as some expect this coming year. Fisherman Ed Wood questioned why the agency couldn't just use the record of landing, the fish tickets, which show the actual poundage and the actual price paid for the fish in real time.
I mean, if you can't look at the fish ticket prices, you shouldn't even be taking money from us.
NIMS staffers expressed a willingness to work with the fleet on this and other issues. The Alaska Region's Sally Bibb emphasized that they wanted a system that was as fair as it could be. The new observer program goes into effect January 1st. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Caribou hunting is open in Unit 18 near Bethel. Like last year, subsistence hunters can take two caribou, but some of the language surrounding how hunters are able to take the caribou is different. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Language and the rules concerning how hunters can reach the caribou by snow machines have changed.
The new language is you may not pursue with a motorized vehicle an ungulate that is at or near full gallop.
Isaac Bedingfield is a game warden with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Basically, it boils down to any time the caribou are running, you can't be following them with a motorized vehicle.
The old regulation language was vaguer. It said that you couldn't pursue an animal that is fleeing with a motorized vehicle. It also said that hunters couldn't drive, herd, or molest game with any motorized vehicle. But what exactly did those words mean? Basically, hunt like an elder. Go out, find the caribou, sit at a distance with binoculars, and watch what they're doing.
These elders, you'll see them go upwind of the caribou and just sit. And a lot of times these caribou will just start moving back and forth. And next thing you know, more often than not, these elders are sitting in the middle of the caribou herd and they get the animals they need without chasing them at all.
Obviously exercising patience and looking for a scenario that results in less disturbance to those animals.
Spencer Reardon is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Bethel.
This is all geared towards reducing the disturbance on caribou.
The population of concern is the Mulchatna caribou herd, which has seen a dramatic decline in the past 15 years. It peaked at 200,000 animals in 1996, then plummeted to 30,000 in 2008. 10 years ago, subsistence hunters could take 5 caribou a season, male or female, but hunting laws have become more restrictive to help protect the herd. The reasons for the decline are unknown, but probably stem from a variety of factors, not all of which can be measured.
There could be other hunter-caused mortality that we can't measure. Animals that have become disturbed so much throughout the winter that they may be predisposed to predation, or they just run out of energy and have a hard time making it through the winter. And since we do have a long season under the state regs until middle of March, that's a long time that hunters have access to these animals.
Managers say what they can focus on is helping caribou during the winter months when their fat stores are dwindling and they're being targeted by hunters. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Sitka basketball legend Herb Diedrichsen has been named to the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. Diedrichsen was selected for the honor over the weekend, along with former Eielson football coach Buck Nystrom. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Diedrichsen first rose to prominence in basketball as a student at what was then Sheldon Jackson School in Sitka, where he graduated in 1946. Diedrichsen says the main influence of World War II on his game was the opportunity to play against college athletes who had joined the military and were based in Sitka. I give a lot of credit to the Navy being there and teaching us a few things, along with those college boys, he says. Diedrichsen is in Anchorage undergoing medical treatment. He was characteristically modest on hearing the news that he had been named to the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame.
Teammates that brought you further than that made things so much better. I give a lot of credit to my teammates.
The roster of players who shared the court with Didrikson at Sheldon Jackson School reads almost like a Hall of Fame in its own right. Joe Truitt, David Leisk, Lawrence, Buddy Widmark Jr., and Ed Benson. Later, in Didrikson's years dominating gold medal basketball, he was teamed up with players on a Sitka A and B squad that included Moses Johnson, Jerry Helland, Willie Joseph, and Franco Williams. Didrikson was the first player ever named to the Gold Medal Basketball Hall of Fame in 1961, 3 years before his retirement. Nominating documents refer to Didrikson as far more than a regional standout. He is described as one of the most gifted athletes of his era, who was recruited by the Seattle Rainiers to play minor league baseball. Didrikson says he considered an athletic career beyond Sitka and the region, but he made family his priority.
At this particular time, my wife was carrying our daughter, so not knowing too much about going to classes in college playing basketball, but I was worried about whether I'd be able to support my family. So I kind of just dropped that.
Didrikson married his high school sweetheart, Pollyanna Lott, in 1948, a marriage that has endured 64 years. This was the third time Didrikson had been nominated for the Alaska Hall. Director Harlow Robinson says it became evident over the years that this was someone who needed to be in the hall. He was an iconic, legendary figure in his era. Along with Didrikson and Nystrom, who won 150 games at Eielson and North Pole in a 30-year career coaching high school football, the Alaska Sports Hall selected the Fairbanks Equinox Marathon for induction in the Invents category, and Soldotna fisherman Les Anderson's 97-pound king salmon and Chris Clark's 2000 Olympic marathon trial victory in the Moments category. A panel of 8 sports writers, broadcasters, and coaches comprise the selection committee. The voting public serves as a 9th member. There were 43 nominees this year. The Alaska Sports Hall of Fame inducted its first class in 2007. Susan Butcher and Tommy Moe were among those named. Didrikson and Nystrom will be inducted in a ceremony at the Anchorage Museum this coming February. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.